The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
In any case, let's go ahead and begin the sermon today. Last week, I had given a sermon explaining the truth about Gog and Magog. And the sermon was given because of all of the speculation that is going on right now regarding the war in the Ukraine. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of religious leaders that are claiming that Ezekiel's prophesied attack of Gog and Magog in the Middle East, that this is going to begin very soon. And this rhetoric has even affected people in the Church of God. And so, because some are being misled and are developing a misunderstanding of the subject, we thought it was important to revisit the truth about Gog and Magog. And therefore, while we revisited biblical history, we also looked at quotes from what would be considered secular or perhaps extra-biblical history to explain who these people are and what the prophesied assault is about and when it will take place. And so we began by going back to Genesis and considering the first mention of Magog being a grandson of Noah, who was born through Japheth. And Japheth, we understand, is the father of people of the Orient, but as well as a father of Arabic peoples and some Indian folk as well. We read that Gog was a great-great-grandson of Reuben. And we also read several excerpts from extra-biblical sources that are credible, indicating that Gog and Magog became several prominent nations north, east, and even south of Israel. We read from the Book of Jubilees. We read from the Book of Biblical Antiquities written by Philo. We read from some of Josephus' Antiquities of the Jews, as well as a few other books. And we saw that Gog and Magog are directly connected to people of Asia, the people of Russia, of Kazakhstan, the Ukraine even, Turkey, Ethiopia, and also other Arab nations. And so history depicts these people as generally hostile and a threat to their national neighbors. And some of the stories that I have read about these people documented over the centuries appear legendary and or I could say embellished. But others seem simply matter of fact without bias or intent. And then we read Ezekiel's prophecy of these people in order to establish the timeline of exactly when these events or when that event will occur. But we did not simply go to Ezekiel 38, as most people do, and start trying to explain it from that chapter alone. We read the context. So we looked at chapters 36, 37, 38, and we read part of 39. Now, because of the depth of the coverage in last week's sermon, it went longer than I expected it to go. And perhaps it was necessary to take that much time. But part two of the study today is not going to be so lengthy. There's not much or as much material to cover because we've already established a strong foundation showing us who Gog and Magog are, what are they related to, and also when that battle will, or that assault, I should say, will take place. So I had already spoken to some people, even some people in this room, who said they're quite confused about the subject, and they remain confused about the subject. And it's understandable, because it has taken many, many hours of study and research to go through the subject and to consider what the Bible says about these people, how it matches other prophetic events, how it matches other prophecies that speak of the same event, and I don't expect everybody to just be able to digest it in one sitting. So I would recommend for those people who remain confused, if you really want to know about the subject and understand it, use the sermon that was given last week as well as this one. It's pre-recorded. I mean, I should say it's recorded, and it will remain on our YouTube channel, and we started a Rumble channel this past week, so we'll put it up on there as well. Both of those are going to be available or are available from our website. But you can go back and review those and pause frequently, because I know some people go like, wait a minute, I'm not putting the pieces together, but I have to keep talking, otherwise the sermon will go even much longer. So pause, process it, digest it, write down questions. If you have questions, email us, we'll get back to you if something doesn't make sense or if there's something maybe we didn't consider, because we don't claim to know everything. We don't. We know we do not know everything. We might know a lot, but there's still a lot that we don't know. So we are open for input from other people if you think that there's something that we are mistaken about. In any case, the foundation was set last week when we went through chapter 36 of Ezekiel. We saw that that was a prophecy of the second Exodus. And that is an event that will occur after Christ returns. It's not symbolic of the Jews resettling in the Middle East after World War II. That's what most people point to, but it's not. It is speaking of a literal second Exodus when the 12 tribes will be gathered from around the world. Most of them don't even know that they're related to the tribes of Israel. They'll be brought back into that land after Christ returns. And there are literally dozens of prophecies and scriptures in the Bible showing that that is an event that will occur. So that miraculous event has not happened yet. It has not. No matter what people say, it has not happened yet. But because most people do not understand this, they don't understand the millennial reign of Jesus Christ, they don't understand his chosen saints that are going to reign with him, they misinterpret such verses and try to fit it into the context of things that are happening right now. So we went forward and we read 37, and we saw how chapter 37 of Ezekiel talks about dry bones being raised up, a valley filled, as it says, with dry bones, very dry, indicating that they're very, very old. And this was symbolic of the second resurrection. This is something that Ezekiel saw take place in a vision, but it described God bringing teeming masses of people back to life, back from the grave. And so that is an event that is going to happen when? 1,000 years after Christ's return, and we read Revelation 20 and verse 5 to confirm this, that says, after the rest of the dead did not live again until the 1,000 years were finished. And that is reflected in the prophecy of Ezekiel 37. Now, the vast majority of people that read the Bible do not understand the resurrections. They don't understand entirely. They might get little pieces of it, but they don't understand the plan of mankind. God calls it, in fact, a mystery. In fact, Christ said he spoke in parables at times on purpose so that they wouldn't understand everything. But to you, to those people who are called, God gives a spirit of understanding so that we can put the pieces together. But again, those people that do not put the pieces together consider that description of a literal resurrection of the dead, bringing them back to physical life. They misinterpret it and again see that as representing the Jews being restored to Israel, the land of Israel in 1948. They see it as simply or purely symbolic. And so we saw that at the same time of the second resurrection, Satan is released from his prison, and he is going to go out and he will deceive people again in the four corners of the earth, it says. And for the next some 100 years after that, while the rest of the dead are experiencing a world of peace and prosperity, the likes of which the earth has never seen, lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life, combined with Satan's influence on individuals, is going to convince many people to turn against God's way of life. And it's during that time that large numbers of people are going to come together. They are going to form an unholy alliance, and they will seek to attack, to plunder the Holy Land. And this set the stage for the attack of Gog and Magog. They are also called in chapter 38, as we went through chapter 38 last week. They are called a people that have the Prince of Rosh, referring to people of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. And we saw how those terms refer to Russia, to Moscow, and Tobolsk. We also read that Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya are among them, as well as a people called Gomer and Togarma. And so all these people combined make up Gog of Magog, and they consist of many nationalities, whether it be Persian or Arab or Asian, Indian, white and black people make up Gog and Magog. The Confederation represents a multinational alliance that will come together with this common goal to pillage that prominent land of Israel that will have been the center of pure religion for 1,000 years. And Ezekiel had said in chapter 38 that they will come against lands without fortified walls, without bars, without gates. And the reason is because it will be a land that has not learned the ways of war for a millennium. And so the people that come up against them will come, as it is described, as bows, arrows, javelins. They will be riding horses. They will have other primitive weapons of war, weapons that we would consider primitive. And the reason is because industry and technology for 1,000 years has not been focused on war, has not been geared on weapons, on protection, or perhaps assault. So there will be no guns, there will be no tanks, there will be no missiles, there will be no fighter jets. None of that will exist at that time. And that's so people will begin to make primitive weapons. Skilled weapons, but primitive nonetheless. And so it says that God will send a flooding rain, great hailstones, fire, and brimstone to destroy Gog and Magog. And he is also going to destroy those people around the world that are motivated by the evil that motivates Gog and Magog. And so in chapter 39, we went through part of that chapter. It says that Israel will use the weapons that those people will bring up, that will be strewn all around the plains, the fields, the mountains, that they will use those weapons from the battlefield for firewood for 7 years. 7 years after it's over. It says they will not take wood from the field or cut down any forests, and this further indicates the timing of that event. It will be a time when there will be a much simpler way of life, a way of life that I'm looking very forward to, a way of life that's more, gives you time to reflect and to think, and it's not focused on get, instead of get, it'll be focused on giving and helping one another. And so using wood for fuel in the home, or perhaps in forms of industry, will be the norm. That will be the way people will function. They won't be using things, I don't think, such as fossil fuels that greatly pollute the environment. So finally, we read in Revelation 20 the parallel prophecy. And so that sermon that we went through covered two interpretations of Ezekiel 38, two interpretations of Gog and Magog. And that is really just about all you need to know in order to understand the truth about Gog and Magog. But there are a few more things that we should consider, and they don't require as much explaining, but we should probably review them. Even though they are not common interpretations of Gog and Magog, they should be mentioned in today's message, which today's message could be considered more like supplemental material to last week's sermon. And so this is the truth about Gog and Magog, part 2. And so let's go over to Revelation 16, Revelation chapter 16. There are a few other opinions about Gog and Magog, and one of them places the prophecy of Ezekiel 38 along with the battle of Armageddon. Well, that would align with what I would consider the common interpretation of Ezekiel 38, that that people believe it is going to be fulfilled before Christ returns. And so let's read this prophecy here. And this prophecy, obviously, as we read it, we'll see it's connected to the bowl plagues. Revelation 16 and verse 12 says that the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up, so that the way of the kings from the east might be prepared. So this is referring to a coalition of armed forces from eastern nations. And it goes on to say, and then I saw three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon. speaking of Satan, and out of the mouth of the beast, the individual and the empire that Satan is using at that time, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. And they are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them together to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. So it is obviously speaking of miraculous, supernatural, and yet demonic forces that are going to be used at that time to gather people to this great battle. And it goes on to say, "Behold, I'm coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame." So again, watches. Blessed is he who watches. Not watches Fox News, but watches himself or herself. Keeps his garments clean, symbolizing righteousness, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And then it concludes this thought with verse 16, "And they gathered them," speaking of those armies, "they gathered them together to the place called in Hebrew Armageddon." Now, there is obviously a demonic element to this plague, but it includes kings of the east. And it also says, we have to note, not just kings of the east, it says kings of the earth and of the whole world. And they're gathered together for this battle of that great day of God. So they're gathered to a place that's called Armageddon, or it's translated as Armageddon here. And this is translated from a Hebrew term that means city or Mount Megiddo. And so it's a central area that's of a central location of an entire area that's referred to as Megiddo. Megiddo is approximately 70 miles north of Jerusalem. It was once inhabited by the tribe of Manasseh, and Megiddo is described in Judges and chapter 1 as having towns, villages, and three hilly regions. Now this area, if you look at a map of this area today, it remains very well populated, even though there are miles of open land that is used mostly for agriculture. So the gathering we see is a result of this sixth bowl plague, but the gathering began actually much longer before that, or quite a bit of time previously. And it was actually mentioned during the sixth trumpet plague. And so let's go back a few pages to Revelation 9. Revelation 9 in verse 13. Where John described here, "Then the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. And so the four angels who had been prepared for the hour and the day and the month and the year were released to kill a third of mankind." And I believe this is referring to demons that have been bound, that are bound at this time, as the scriptures say. There are demons constrained at this time, but they're going to be released in order that a third of mankind will be killed. And then it goes on to say in verse 16, and this is a focal point of what I'm going to read, "Now the number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million, and I heard the number of them, and thus I saw the horses in the vision. And those who sat on them had breastplates of fiery red, hyacinth blue, and sulfur yellow. And the heads of the horses were like the heads of lions, and out of their mouths came fire, smoke, and brimstone." So this is likely referring to some kind of weaponry that is being used by this 200 million man army that is going to be used. Fire, smoke, and brimstone, as that's what John had saw in the vision. And then it says, "By these three," talking about the fire, the smoke, and the brimstone, "a third of mankind was killed by the fire, the smoke, and the brimstone which came out of their mouths. For their power is in their mouth and in their tails, for their tails are like serpents having heads, and with them they do harm." And then it goes on to say, "But the rest of mankind who were not killed by these plagues did not repent of their works, of their hands, that they should not worship demons and idols of gold, silver, brass, stone, and wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. And they did not repent of their murders or their sorceries or their sexual immorality or their thefts. And so like the sixth bowl plague, the sixth trumpet plague is going to involve some demonic supernatural forces. But it says, it points to a gathering of an army that numbers 200 million. Now, I know a lot of people don't think of a million being as much as we may have in the past, because people spend millions or billions of dollars today. Corporations are taking over, and we're just going to spend $7.2 billion or what have you. And it's, I mean, that amount of money is it's such a huge number, it really is. It's estimated that America's current military numbers approximately 2.5 million. We have the largest military in the world at this time. Second to us is Russia, with over 2 million. And after that, third, but it's being ramped up, they're going to be second soon, is China. China has approximately 2 million soldiers. However, all of these nations, they all have a population that has tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of people that are actually fit to serve in the military, but they choose not to, or they are not drafted. And so it is that the number that consists at this time is a huge number, but I believe, and it points to, what this points to is a coalition of armed forces. It's not simply one nation with a 200 million man army. And we're going to see that as we read a little bit more. If you go back to Daniel 11 for a moment, Daniel 11, when we consider the timeline of the trumpet plagues as well as the bowl plagues, we find that they all take place in a single year, a 360-day period. It's called the Day of the Lord's Vengeance. It's called the Year of Recompense, of God's Recompense. And that year, that final year before Christ's return, begins when the first trumpet plague is blown. And we're well aware of that timeline. We've talked about it many times over the years, particularly during the memorial of the blowing of trumpets. So clearly, an army of this size would consist of many battalions that would have been preparing for war long before the Battle of Armageddon, and long before, in fact, that year of God's wrath begins. It takes time for people to organize in such a way, such a huge number of people to go up and fight. And so they will have been active for quite some time before the events preceding the Great Tribulation. Now, Daniel 11 indicates that there will be very much political and military maneuvering before the Great Tribulation begins and after it begins. Alliances will be formed, alliances will be broken, and the army of the beast will have moved against the Middle East. In Daniel 11, and much of Daniel actually talks about that time, but we're not going to go through all of it today. I think I'm just going to go to verse 40, where it says, "At that time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come up against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through." And so the king of the south is an Arab confederacy. And the north refers to north of Jerusalem. It's going to be a united Europe. "He also shall enter," it says, "the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon." So it's talking about people of Turkey and Jordan. "He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and over the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But," it says, "news from the east and the north," so it's talking about Asia and Russia, "shall trouble him, and therefore she shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many." And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. But he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. So it's talking about a headquarters of this beast power that is going to be planted in the Middle East. Now, the glorious land that was mentioned in this prophecy refers, obviously, to the land of Israel. And north and east of Israel are Turkey, Russia, Ukraine, Iran, Iraq. And if you keep going east, there are several of the Stan nations, as well as India and China. Now, any and all of those nations could pose a threat to the European empire led by the beast and false prophet. And some of these areas that I just mentioned are historically locations for Gog and Magog. However, the prophecy about this 200 million man army that's mentioned in the sixth trumpet, as well as the sixth bowl plague, it's going to result in this battle of Armageddon, but it never calls them Gog and Magog. That doesn't make a connection at that point. Even though I think those battalions most definitely will include people that would fall into that category, there are other prophecies of that time, of that end time event, found in Zechariah 14. And I'm not going to read it, but you can read it later. Zechariah 14, verses 2 through 14. You can also look at Joel 2 and the first 11 verses of Joel 2. And also Revelation 19, which I'm going to go to in a moment. But none of those prophecies call that battle Gog and Magog. And that's significant. And so let's go over to Revelation 19. Despite this, some still try to compare the evil forces of Ezekiel 38 to the Battle of Armageddon, and they might consider the cleanup of Armageddon. After that battle is over, it says in Revelation 19, and we're going to read verses 17 through 21. After the beast and his armies are defeated, it says, "Then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds that fly in the midst of heaven, come and gather together for the supper of the great God." What's this about? Is this the marriage supper? Oh, no. This is something very different. It goes on to say, "That you may eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses and of those who sit on them, and the flesh of all people, free and slave, both small and great." And I saw the beast, the kings of the earth, and their armies gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. It's talking about the white horse that Christ rode in the previous verses, starting in verse 11. Of the same chapter. In verse 20 it says, "Then the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet who worked signs in his presence by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast, and these two were cast into the lake burning with brimstone. And the rest were killed with the sword which proceeded from the mouth of him who sat on the horse." And then it concludes saying, "And all the birds were filled with their flesh." Now, the conclusion of the battle of Gog and Magog, as described by Ezekiel in his vision, says in verse 4 of Ezekiel 39, "You shall fall upon the mountain," talking of Gog and Magog, "you shall fall upon the mountains of Israel, you and all your troops and the peoples that are with you, and I will give you to birds of prey of every sort and to the beasts of the field to be devoured." And so we can see that there is a similarity here in what is going on and how the corpses, the bodies of those people, are disposed of after these events. However, we must recognize that this is simply an efficient way of cleaning up millions of bodies that will quickly begin to rot and stink and, you know, make way for disease. So to deal with it, logically, God brings down those thousands, hundreds of thousands of those animals that he designed to be a cleanup crew, to clean this up. And so the connection between the battle of Armageddon and Gog and Magog of Ezekiel, it's purely speculation. So don't get, you know, when people try to put those two together and say, look, it's the same, it's the same. It's just something similar is happening. It is not describing the same event. There is no evidence that they are the same event. But as we pointed out last week, and as we'll, you know, show some more of today, there is much evidence pointing to those being separate events and being separated by a span of just over 1,000 years. Or a little more than 1,000 years, actually. It's more like 1,100 years in our estimation. In any case, let's go back to Ezekiel 38 very briefly. Back to Ezekiel chapter 38. Attempting to match Ezekiel 38 with the Battle of Armageddon would require people to consider Ezekiel's descriptions of a second Exodus in chapter 36, a resurrection of the dead in chapter 37, villages without bars and gates, and primitive weapons of war, and other details that we have talked about. They would have to consider them all to just be purely symbolic. There's nothing literal about any of it. It's all symbolic. Now, if that were the case, of course, then the only literal detail about Ezekiel's prophecy of Gog and Magog would be the assault itself. But we had seen in the last sermon that instead of it being vastly symbolic, that Ezekiel's prophecy is a literal description of events that are going to actually happen, just as God said. Now, if you're getting warm, I'm not sure if that's set, but you can go ahead and turn it down. I know some people might be getting there. I see the fans starting to go. There is a fourth opinion. So we've discussed three opinions so far in these two sermons. There is a fourth opinion of the timing of Ezekiel 38. And you may not have heard of this, because there are very few that actually think this, but some think that the battle of Gog and Magog is going to occur after Christ returns. They will admit to that, but not 1,000 years later. Some people believe that the uprising is not going to be a result of Satan deceiving people after he is released from his prison and gone out into the four corners of the earth, but that the assault will be the result of people who have not been converted yet during the process of transition from the governments of men to the kingdom of God when Christ establishes his kingdom on the earth. And they believe that this is going to take place just a few years after Christ returns. That Gog and Magog will take place maybe 2, maybe 10 years after Christ returns. Now, Ezekiel 38 in verse 11 says that you will go up against a land of unwalled villages. That you will go to a peaceful people who dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates. And we had read that last week. And we understand that this is talking about a territory that was given to Israel, and it was given to a people that will inherit that land, or will be brought back into that land once again during the second Exodus that we read in chapter 36. But also it is going to be a land that will be given to their ancestors, the people of Israel that will be raised from the dead decades prior. And so the fourth opinion, of course, holds that this is not talking about that. That it's talking about a time maybe 2, 5, 10 years after Christ returns. So the mistaken conclusion does not take into account the fact that the second Exodus is mentioned 2 chapters earlier, that a second resurrection is foretold in the previous chapter, and then we have the battle of Gog and Magog. And though some chapters, we do find that some chapters in the book of Ezekiel are not chronological, that they will jump back and forth occasionally in time, we must admit that many of them are chronological. And in fact, when we compare the second witness found from the vision given by Christ himself, delivered to John through an angel, the sequence found in Revelation 20 matches what Ezekiel describes in more detail. So the indication that there are unwalled cities or villages means that people are no longer fortifying their lands. They are no longer trying to defend themselves from invaders. And of course, this would be the case whether the attack occurred a few years after Christ returns or 1,000 years, 1,100 years later. So this fourth opinion also questions the people that are mentioned, the people of Gog, of the land of Magog, in Ezekiel, and also the Gog and Magog of Revelation 20. And some say that actually they're different people, that they are not talking about the same people. And so Ezekiel, as we had talked about already, it mentions people of Rosh, of Meshech, of Tubal, of Gomer and Togarma, Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya. And these are all nationalities, and they also speak of territories that of people that will come together, form this alliance, and they will set off to invade. So Revelation 20 speaks of people coming from the four corners of the earth. Do those two descriptions actually make the people different? Does it consider different people? No, not at all. I point again to something we had talked about last week, indicating that all of those names refer to people that are now scattered around the world. They are in different locations all around the planet, even though many of them are still centralized in some of the areas north, east, and also south of Jerusalem. So another believed difference is the fact that Satan will go out to deceive the nations in Revelation 20, and we had read that. He will be released from his prisons. He will go out and deceive the nations, people in the four corners of the earth. Ezekiel 38 and verse 4 says that God will turn you around and put hooks into your jaws and lead you out with all your army, your horses, and your horsemen. So they say that's different. One is Satan's doing and one is God's doing. It's different. Well, the simple explanation is that, well, when Satan inspires the greed, the evil, God will lead these people to destruction. And that is a very simple and logical explanation. In fact, the blame cannot be placed on Satan alone. In verse 10 of this chapter, it says, "Thus says the Eternal God, on that day it shall come to pass that thoughts will arise in your mind, and you will make an evil plan." Oh, yeah, Satan is edging them along, maybe trying to inspire some evil thoughts, but it's people can't put all the blame on Satan like Eve did. Oh, no. It's all his fault. Well, wait a minute, Eve. You're able to choose. You have the ability to say, no, I'm not going to do that. Can't blame Satan for all of the evil in the world. People have a large role to play in this. And this, in fact, was a similar situation with Assyria and also with Babylon. Now, God allowed those nations to come down and attack Israel and also Judah. But God did not inspire it. He did not inspire the greed. He did not inspire the brutality of these people. In fact, James 1 and verse 13 says that God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. So God does not inspire covetousness. He doesn't inspire adultery. He doesn't inspire pride. He allows it to exist. And he allows it to exist for a purpose, so that people might experience it or at least see the results of living that way of life, of where those attitudes and behaviors will lead. Now, sometimes the purpose is to punish people who reject him. And so in one case, and there's several scriptures pointing to this, when God says that he will bring people down, that he will lead them down to destroy Israel, when he talked of Assyria, and also of Judah, in Jeremiah 5 and verse 15, it says, "Behold, I will bring a nation against you, Judah, from afar, a house of Israel," says the Eternal. "It is a mighty nation. It is an ancient nation, a nation whose language you do not know, nor can you understand what they say." So they don't. Who are they? We don't understand what they're relating to another. It's a different language here. But later, God says of Babylon and also of Assyria, and several scriptures, Nahum 2 is one of those, that he is going to punish those people for their evil, for their brutality, for their greed. you know, although God allows the war to take place, he can take credit for it in that way, saying that I brought this punishment upon you. But it's only in the sense that he didn't stop it. He didn't stop it from happening. He just said, okay, you want to go your own way? You want to go against my way? You want to walk away from me? Okay, my hands are off. You're on your own. And what's going to happen when God takes his protection away from people? Invaders are going to come. People are going to come in and try to conquer and take. And so God isn't the inspiration for murder. He's not the inspiration for theft. And such will be the case in the future. So instead of God causing the evil of Gog and Magog, Ezekiel 38 instead relates that he is going to be the one that is going to reel these people in. He's going to catch the fish that's fit to be fried, is what he is relating here. Ezekiel 38 and verse 16 says that you will come up against my people, Israel, like a cloud to cover the land, and it will be in the latter days that I will bring you against my land so that the nations may know me when I am hallowed in you, O Gog, before their eyes. So a reason for this is to show the nations that he is God. He says it himself. He's showing the nations, look, I'm not a pushover. I exist, and I am the Almighty. And this, because this statement is made here, it has led some to think that God, well, he still needs to display his sovereignty just a few years after Christ returns, that he still has to show the people that he is God, that he is all-powerful. Well, how could this be? Why would God need to show the world that he is God just after the tribulation, just after the plagues, just after Christ's dramatic return and a miraculous re-healing of the planet? I mean, think about it. All the green grass burned up all around the planet, potable water all over the earth, turned to poison. Everything in the ocean dies. There will be sunken vessels that will be clogging up the seaports all over the planet. Plagues of searing pain will be inflicted on people, tormented for months. There will be miraculous signs that will be given in the moon and the stars and the heavens. There will be hail. As I had illustrated in one sermon, I brought it out and covered a beach ball, hail the size of beach balls, that will destroy entire cities. The Battle of Armageddon will have taken place, where it says that the Lord, and this is Zechariah 14:12, the Lord will strike all the people who fought against Jerusalem, that 200 million man army. The flesh, their flesh, it says, shall dissolve while they stand on their feet. Their eyes shall dissolve in their sockets. Their tongues shall dissolve in their mouths. So the world's population, after all of these events, is going to be drastically reduced at that time. Hundreds of millions are going to die. And Christ is going to return. He's going to shake the world and reestablish its axis so that we have a perfect calendar of which everybody will be able to observe God's holy days. He's going to reshape the Middle East, making it possible for a millennial temple to be built in that land. And we see the nature of animals is going to be changed at that time. And there are going to be miracles of healing the sick and the diseased, and deserts are going to blossom like a rose. So those who survive all of those events, those people who survive the tribulation, the year of God's recompense, and live on into the millennium, they will have seen much of this take place firsthand. And yet some people think, well, God's going to still need to let the people know that he's God. After all of that, now he's going to bring up an army with primitive weapons, of which, by the way, there's going to be all kinds of rubble around the world. I think God will have a hand in getting rid of, liquidating, if you will, a lot of the damage that people have done to the planet over thousands of years. But there's going to be a lot of cleanup for people to do. God's not going to clean up all of the mess for us. So why would people be building primitive weapons when there are still millions of guns around and all hand grenades, rocket launchers, all kinds of things? Why would people need primitive weapons? Well, they wouldn't. However, after 1,000 years of peace, there will have been no need for great miracles. All will have learned the way of God as the knowledge of God covers the earth like the waters of the sea. Most people alive at that time, after 1,000 years, when Satan is loosed, most of those people will have not experienced the Great Tribulation. They didn't receive all those plagues. They didn't see the healing of the earth. They didn't see all of those things that had occurred for centuries. And so Satan is going to be released. He is going to go out. He is going to deceive people once again. And that is at that time when people will need a reminder of God's sovereignty, that he is God, that he's not a pushover. Look, it's been quiet for 1,000 years, and you've enjoyed a lot. People tend to forget, don't we? We tend to forget the past, the history. Look what we see happening in this country, in this world today. We forget figuratively speaking, we forget what happened a couple hundred years ago. Look what happens when you allow socialism to take control. And so Ezekiel 39, we're almost finished here. When the assault of Gog and Magog is stopped and the armies are annihilated, there will be millions of bodies scattered on the mountains, the plains, and the field. And in verse 4, it says that you shall fall upon the mountains of Israel and all your troops and the peoples who are with you, and I will give you to birds of prey of every sort and to the beasts of the field to be devoured. You shall fall on the open field, for I have spoken, says the Eternal God. I will send fire on Magog and those who live in security in the coastlands, and then they shall know that I am the Eternal. Again, as we had mentioned last week, this is talking about people that were supporting the rebellion, supporting the assault. And so I will make my name holy in the midst of my people Israel and will not let them profane my holy name anymore. And so we see that Satan will be deceiving people in the four corners of the earth, not outside of Jerusalem and Israel alone, that there will be people who will be swayed, maybe not to a point of attacking and trying to kill others for gold and silver, but it says apparently people will begin to profane his name again. They're not going to profane it anymore. And the nation shall know that I am the Eternal, the Holy One in Israel. Surely it's coming, and it shall be done, says the Eternal God. This is the day of which I have spoken. And then those who dwell in the city of Israel will go out and set fire and burn the weapons, both the shields and the bucklers and the bows and the arrows and the javelins and the spears, and they will make fires with them for 7 years. They will not take wood from the field nor cut down any from the forests, because they will make fires with the weapons. And they will plunder those who plundered them and pillage those who pillaged them, says the Eternal God. In other words, they're taking those usable items and they will be repurposed. So it will come to pass in that day that I will give Gog a burial place there in Israel, the valley of those who pass by the east of the sea, and it will obstruct travelers, because there they will bury Gog and all his multitude. So this is going to be a huge burial location, in as much as that it obstructs travelers. Got to go around. And therefore they will call it the valley of Hamon Gog, which basically means the multitude of Gog. That's what it means. For 7 months, the house of Israel will be burying them in order to cleanse the land. Indeed, all the people of the land will be burying, and they will gain honor or renown for it in one day that I am glorified. On the day I am glorified, says the Eternal God. They will set apart men regularly employed with the help of a search party to pass through the land and bury those bodies remaining on the ground in order to cleanse it. And at the end of 7 months, they will make a search, and the search party will pass through the land, and when anyone sees a man's bone, he shall set up a marker by it till the buriers have buried it in the valley of Hamon Gog. And the name of the city will also be Hamanoah, which basically means a multitude. And thus they shall cleanse the land. And so this is not symbolic. This is literally something that is going to happen. And it makes sense. It's a logical, an efficient way of disposing of the bones. And as for you, son of man, thus says the Eternal God, speak to every sort of bird and every beast of the field, assemble yourselves and come gather together from all sides to my sacrificial meal, which I am sacrificing for you, a great sacrificial meal in the mountains of Israel, that you may eat flesh and drink blood, and you shall eat the flesh of the mighty, drink the blood of the princes of the earth, of rams and lambs and goats and bulls, and of all of them fatlings of Bashan. And this is a place where cattle were bred, reflecting the wealth and the strength that these people will have had. And you shall eat fat till you are full, and drink blood till you are drunk. And at my sacrificial meal, which I am sacrificing for you, you shall be filled at my table with horses and riders, with mighty men, with all men of war, says the Eternal God. I will set my glory among the nations. All the nations shall see my judgment, which I have executed, and my hand, which I have laid on them. And so the house of Israel shall know that I am the Eternal, their God, from that day forward. The Gentiles also shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity, because they were unfaithful to me. And therefore I hid my face from them, and I gave Israel into the hand of their enemies, and they all fell by the sword. So reflecting back on the time previously, which again, people forget, even though we have a history book, even though we have years of history of these events, people discount it. Myth, legend. According to their uncleanness and according to their transgressions, I have dealt with them and hidden my face from them. And therefore, thus says the Eternal God, now I will bring back the captives of Jacob and have mercy on the whole house of Israel, and I will be jealous for my holy name after they have borne their shame and all their unfaithfulness, in which they were unfaithful to me when they dwelt safely in their own land and no one made them afraid. When I have brought them back from the peoples and gathered them out of the enemy's lands, and I am hallowed in them in the sight of many nations. And I think this is kind of combining the thoughts of bringing back Israel, the second Exodus, bringing back Israel from the dead. Then they shall know that I am the Eternal God who sent them into captivity among the nations, but also brought them back to their land and left none of them captive any longer. None of them. Not one. Because even those people that may not have been taken captive by Assyria or Babylon, or died in those lands, or lived peacefully in Israel when there were years of prosperity, that they will be brought back from the captivity of the grave. And I will not hide my face from them anymore, for I shall have poured out my spirit on the house of Israel, says the Eternal God. And so let's go for a final scripture over to Revelation 20. Revelation 20, because this is a match to those events, Ezekiel 36, 37, 38, 39. And let's go ahead and we'll just read the first 10 verses here. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand, and he laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And of course, we understand this is going to take place on the Day of Atonement when Christ returns. That's what atonement pictures. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should not deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years were finished. But after those things, he must be released for a little while. And I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. And that's what? The first resurrection. And it even goes on to say, but the rest of the dead did not live again until 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection, speaking of what took place in the previous verse. Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ and shall reign with him 1,000 years. Now when 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea, another huge army. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. And fire came down from God out from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and false prophet were cast. and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. This is referring from an age to an age, meaning that they're going to be tormented from this age to this age, then it's over. They're dead. So it's only after this, all of these events take place, that there is going to be a final judgment. After there are no more bodies to bury, after there are no more weapons to burn, at some point after the 7 years, there will be a third and final resurrection. And God is going to summon all people, raise them up as spirit beings to his great white throne to judge them. People will have to give an account for why they chose to live their lives the way they did. In Revelation 20, and verse 11 through 15, I saw a great white throne, and him who sat on it, from whose face of the earth and heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God, and the books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged according to their works by the things which were written in the books. So there's a record of events. It's portraying a record of your life, of my life, of people's lives, of what you did. And they're going to compare it to the other books. Let's see how it aligns with the ethics of God. Let's see if you made the right choices. And the sea gave up the dead that were in it, and death and Hades delivered up the dead who were in them, and they were judged, each one according to his works. And then death and Hades, or the grave, were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. So this is the final judgment, the white throne judgment, that is going to be result finally in an end to all war, to all greed, to all selfish behavior and attitudes. It will see the end of hate. It will see the end of oppression. And some people say today that women are being oppressed because they are not allowed to murder babies. Well, that is oppression in itself. It's going to see an end to such rhetoric. It's going to see an end to those people that are portraying death as life today. And those found worthy will be changed. Those unworthy will suffer the second death in the lake of fire. And if you think about it, this is really a loving plan. This is a merciful plan that God has established. You know, he is not going to force people who love peace and want to be helpful and love to serve others and help others. He is not going to force them to be tormented by people who are greedy and selfish and want to do harm to people that do good, to force them to live with those people for the rest of their lives. And also, he is not going to force those people who love violence, people who love wickedness and greed, he is not going to force them to be righteous, to live a righteous life. If you don't want that, that's fine. You're dead. It's all over. Quick and easy. So all will have their opportunity to choose life or to choose death. And that choice is being made in how we live our lives today. What is it that we choose? Now, not everybody understands this plan right now, which is evident in the fact that not everyone is called at this time. It's God's intent not to call everyone at this time. Now is not the only time of salvation. We have a booklet written on that subject. But God is going to give people another opportunity, people who might misinterpret or misunderstand Gog and Magog, people who might misunderstand the need to live by God's ethics, the need to keep his commandments, all of them, not just picking and choosing what we might want to try to keep. He is going to give another opportunity for people of Israel, people of Edom, people of Russia, people of Turkey, people of Egypt and Africa and Persia and all nations, that people are going to be able to make a choice. And at that time, most people, it's my belief that most people are going to choose life. But apparently there are going to be large numbers of people who will think, well, there's a third option. There's a third, but that's not true. There is no third option. It's one or the other. It's the two trees. over again. And this is the truth about Gog and Magog. And if you find something wrong with this understanding, if you don't think this is correct, prove it. Prove it to yourself. Prove it to me. Prove it to us. Send us a message. Give us a call. Let us know where we're wrong. You know, we don't claim to know everything. We don't know everything. We know quite a bit, but not everything. So if there's something you see that is incorrect and it can be proven, we'll accept that. And we will change if it's right. But if you cannot prove this to be wrong, if you can't find a flaw in this understanding, perhaps we need to consider, is it right? Because understanding this truth can be of great value to those people who seek the kingdom of God. Not kingdoms of this world, but the kingdom of God. And that is what you and I seek, and it's my hope that we all attain it.